One of the big Kansas stories of 2018 that will have a major impact on 2019 was the November elections. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, we'll look back at the 2018 Kansas elections with political insiders, campaign strategists, and journalists. It's the Dole Institute of Politics post-election conference held November 28, 2018. This event featured Jordana Ziegler, campaign manager for Laura Kelly, Dan McNamara, campaign manager for Charisse Davids, Paul Leopold, campaign manager for Steve Watkins, CJ Grover, campaign manager for Kevin Yoder, Carrie Gooch, campaign manager for Paul Davis, Hunter Woodall with the Kansas City Star, John Hanna with the Associated Press, Caroline Sweeney with KCTV5 in Kansas City, Patrick Miller, professor of political science at the University of Kansas, and Jared Soon, a consultant with the Singularis Group, a consulting group that works on Republican campaigns and was previously associated with Chris Kobach's campaign for governor. The Dole Institute invited representatives of Chris Kobach's and Greg Orman's gubernatorial campaigns to participate, but both declined to do so. The Kansas post-election conference was moderated by Bill Lacey, director of the Dole Institute. He asked Jordana Ziegler of Governor-elect Laura Kelly's campaign to start out by describing their strategy for the 2018 election.
I think that what we tried to do as a campaign is run a race that was really authentic to our candidate, to Laura, and authentic to the state of Kansas and to what she was hearing around the state, but in general, what she felt like the state needed. And I believe that we did that. And the way that we did that truly was from a pretty intense message discipline space. From the beginning, our message stayed pretty much the same. And I think we're all very proud of that. We had a small team, a very hardworking team, a team that had a majority, or our entire senior staff actually was women, which was an exciting thing. And I think kind of talked about the kind of state that that Senator Kelly wants to build here in Kansas, and making sure that there's diversity and inclusion in state government and in the state as well. We definitely, we had a primary that I think was competitive for all the right reasons, but I think that we handled really well. Senator Kelly is an extremely hard worker, and because of that, we raised the money we needed to raise. We went on TV in the way that we needed to. We talked to voters directly in ways that I think were important and kind of hit home with them for the most part. And we truly had a message that I think really resonated with the people of Kansas. And that's what we tried to stick with the entire time. And I think there's some benefit to the fact that running for governor is like running for president of a state, that we got to really like drive a message that we wanted to drive. And there wasn't a lot of, there's in the federal races, I think there's a lot more distraction of what's going on with the president or in Washington. And here I believe that we really got to set the tone for what we wanted this campaign to be about. And when it diverged from that, we tried always to kind of pivot back to what our message is, because we felt like our message was really resonating with the voters. I don't know, and honestly, this campaign cycle was really interesting, and I think we had a really good time doing it. I know that sounds maybe silly, but I think that the campaign itself, we start at the top, and Senator Kelly feels very strongly and passionately about that she was the best fit to fix the state and kind of take the state away from the Brownback Tax Experiment and kind of return it to what she believes is possible here. And we took our cue from her and really were able to like run a strong campaign with a small staff, a diverse staff, and a staff that kind of can reflect what she wants the state to be. And then we had a lot of great help along the way from people, from both parties that really believed in the vision that Laura was trying to show to voters.
Would you just spend just a minute or so outlining the basic message? You talked about the message that the governor-elect carried and the campaign carried. What was that message?
Sure. I think it was pretty much threefold. It was And this is why I have communications people, because they're much better at this than me. But it was fully funding our education system, balancing the budget without any new taxes, and then just restoring Kansas to what it once was and ending the brown bag tax experiment.
Okay, thank you very much. I want to move now to Jared Soon with Singularis. Jared was a consultant to the Kobach campaign through the primary, and he is not representing the Secretary of State, but he can speak to kind of what he thought the Kobach primary campaign entailed, but also to start with, Jared, kind of what you saw as you were thinking about the general election, what you saw as the Secretary of State's pathway to victory.
So just to start out with, I think when I was working on the campaign, which was until about May of 2018, I very much was viewing the race from the prism of you had a candidate in Secretary Kobach that came to the table with several attributes that you don't normally see in a candidate like this. He had a very committed and devoted base. He had national stature and national recognition on a number of issues. He had the ear of the president. There was a number of things that he brought to the table to begin with, but he was also very defined as an ideologue, as a talking head, and I felt like it was very, very important as the campaign launched and kicked off to really define him as a leader apart from necessarily an issue set. The governor of a state carries with it a lot of things outside of just your typical issues. You're talking about somebody that people turn to when there's a crisis or any type of natural disaster, and I felt like it was very important to position him as somebody that could lead. That was why we pivoted back so much to a lot of the things that he was on the front lines on during the 9/11, pivoting to the fact that, you know, as Secretary of State, a large number of the proposals that he had pushed were actually supported on a bipartisan viewpoint. Second thing was expanding his issue portfolio. He was obviously very well known on two or three signature issues. I felt like it was very important to expand that to give him a broader footprint of issues that he was really concerned about. The third thing that I felt like was important as you have looked at the pendulum swing, so to speak, in Kansas politics in terms of the governor's office changing hands from party to party over the years, I felt like he needed to position himself as kind of the candidate of change, especially in the post-Brownback era, and to begin to inoculate ourselves, you know, from attacks that he would be labeled as Brownback 2.0. Because it was my vantage point from a strategical standpoint that was actually the most salient hit against him. It wasn't that he was too conservative or that being labeled as Brownback 2.0 would be where we would run into problems. And then finally, we needed to run a very intensely data-driven and very focused campaign. When you're dealing with a candidate that's as highly polarized, and this was a race that was going to be fundamentally won or lost on the margins. It wasn't going to be won and lost by motivating or persuading large pockets of people. And we needed to run a very intensely data-driven campaign that really drilled down on the specific people that we could persuade, and then those that we could motivate to turn out to vote.
The key figure in the race is in Washington. He's now an ambassador. Was Brownback.
John Hanna is a reporter with the Associated Press.
Very clearly in 2016, Kansas voters repudiated the Brownback experiment. There was nothing we saw on the ground that said their feelings had changed about that. Indeed, probably a good sizable majority of them thought the tax experiment was a mistake, and that it was actually bad for Kansas, and they didn't want to continue that. They didn't want to go back to that. So the challenge for Kobach was to differentiate his position on the budget and taxes in favor of tax cuts and a smaller budget from Brownback. And the Kelly campaign stayed right on message on that point. And, you know, there's always this argument in politics that if you're explaining, you're losing. And so toward the end of the campaign, Mr. Kobach was explaining how, even though he was talking about tax cuts, he wasn't talking about the same going back to the Brownback tax experiment. He would do it differently, shrink government, cut spending at the same time so that it might work. And, you know, there was always a sense with Kobach that there was a ceiling somewhere to his support statewide in a general election. Was it 42? Was it 45? Was it 47? What, you know, arguably could it be 50%? But there was very clearly a ceiling there, and then you had this factor with Greg Orman as the independent candidate who turned out not to be as much of a factor as people thought. But I mean, from the beginning, everybody, I think, everywhere kind of understood that this was going to be a debate about Sam Brownback's legacy.
To that end, I always found it interesting. You know, you looked at the state, President Trump won it decidedly in 2016, and Kobach had tied himself so much to Trump, you know, as Jared said, very much had the president's ear.
Hunter Woodall is a reporter for the Kansas City Star.
I think Trump won the state by more than 20 points or so. And you look at this, though, and that ghost of Sam Brownback really did seem to matter more than, you know, President Trump coming out and supporting both Kobach and Watkins in a rally in Topeka. And that kind of surprised me, because I talked to voters, and, you know, I covered both the 3rd Congressional and the 2nd, and voters were very, either they loved the president or they didn't like the president, and that was very clear. And that didn't seem to quite water down to the governor's race, and I'm not sure if that was because of the, you know, people still had that memory of Sam Brownback, or because, you know, maybe Kobach couldn't quite escape that, as Jared said, kind of, you know, ideologue, kind of talking head identity he built for himself. Because Kobach was somebody who, you know, you kind of count that he was always, you know, every other night you might see him on Fox News, he would be talking. And for our sake, he was always pretty accessible to us. And again, as John said, we did anticipate there would be some kind of ceiling, there would be some kind of, okay, you know, are people tapped out? And what was fascinating to me and to my colleague at the Star, Steve Vockrod, a wonderful reporter, made this point on election night that it kind of is similar to Phil Klein, the former attorney general. Can you go too far to the right where, in, you know, Kansas, which is a Republican state, will say, okay, that's too far. We want a little bit, you know, center right, not quite so far right.
What about, and this is mentioned briefly by Jared, what about the Secretary of State's national profile? Is that a plus for him, or is that, at the end of the day, a negative for him?
I don't know. I'm speaking from a broadcast perspective.
Caroline Sweeney is a reporter with KCTV5 in Kansas City.
When we talk about having access to candidates on any level and having their face and their voice in front of voters, that's what I was hearing a lot from the Johnson County, Wyandotte County, and Miami County voters that I was interacting with kind of on a day-to-day basis was, a lot of them wanted to know why, even though we did have access to Secretary Kobach and he did come on KCTV 5 News a lot, they didn't understand why he was going on national programs and not more on local news. And I think because my medium is so visual, broadcast is extremely visual, having that disparity between him always on national news, promoting national news on social media, which the secretary still does on like Facebook and Twitter, that can sometimes send an interesting message to Kansas voters that local media may not be as important as national media. And so that was just something I was hearing from voters a lot, especially when it comes to where candidates' faces and where their voices were showing up. They don't necessarily understand the differences between national and local, and they want more local exposure.
I think it's indisputable to look at his profile and say that those appearances helped fuel his rise. But I think that it also somewhat created a plateau.
Jared Soon is with the Singularis Group, a consulting firm that works on Republican campaigns and was previously associated with Kris Kobach's campaign for governor.
When you're in a campaign like that, you want to drive a specific message. And every one of those appearances as the campaign kind of wore on, I think it became less distinguishable what his message was specifically related to the governor's race. And instead, it kind of went off into these other, where essentially the news of the day was. And there's an element of that that I think is good because you're participating in the debate and you're, but at the end of the day, as has already been pointed out, his name ID didn't need to be increased. Where the focus needed to be at was in a specific issue set.
But he also seemed to kind of do things more than occasionally that, you know, built that kind of, I think the phrase he used was consistent conservative, but he built that kind of conservative warrior image. I mean, the Jeep with the replica machine gun on the back of it that was in every parade. And
Trump bobblehead. Don't forget the Trump bobblehead.
The Trump bobblehead and Ted Nugent signed the glove box.
Again, John Hanna with the Associated Press.
You know, he had this line in debates during the primary, I don't back down, I double down. You know, when people complained about that parade float, he talked about the snowflake meltdown. He was kind of the Kris Kobach that everybody knew and loved. And I was struck by the idea that you were talking about people being able to see him as somebody who can comfort you in a time of natural disaster. And I don't know that he ever, I mean, he's a family man, he's got five daughters and all of that, but I don't know that he ever came across as cuddly.
Something that I found interesting about Secretary Kobach was, I mean, yeah, he started off the race with, just for a Secretary of State, obscene name recognition. I mean, you and I were sitting here on a Wednesday afternoon talking about politics. We're really strange people.
Patrick Miller is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Kansas.
You know, we know who all these elected officials are. Most people don't. So he was a decently well-known quantity. Some chunk of Kansans didn't know who he was. I mean, that was clear in the polling. But his negatives were really high. You know, in the public polling, anywhere between 45% to 55%. And I think if you look at the public polling as the campaign progressed, and as that chunk of voters who I thought would lean naturally Republican, as that decreased, his negatives didn't change. So as people even learned about him during the campaign, he was not really able to change how he was perceived. And one thing that, you know, as a political scientist, it's very hard to quantify, you know, especially like studying an N of one, like a president or a candidate like Kobach or Trump. But I do wonder to what extent the presence of Trump and how people have reacted to him may have made Kobach unpalatable to a degree. I mean, I think it's fair to say that they are both politicians who they're good at putting on a show. I mean, Democrats, you have your Cory Booker and Bernie. Well, Bernie's not a Democrat, but, you know, people like that, they're good at putting on a show. And Kobach was one of those people. And I do wonder, once you finally got someone like Trump in office, for whom the show is very important, if that somehow helped, you know, further limit Kobach, when if Hillary Clinton had won, or John Kasich, or some kind of mainstream Republican, would voters have been more willing to experiment with Kobach's style? I mean, I don't know that. I mean, we look at the polling in Kansas, and you see this across the country. There are a chunk of people who voted for Trump who don't actually approve of the job that he's doing. You know, Trump got, 60% just about in Kansas, but Kansans are split 50-50 on him in terms of job approval. I mean, yeah, Kansas is more moderate than it is Republican in polling, but people like that Republican brand. So, I mean, to the extent, I do think we shouldn't totally discount the role that Trump may have played, because it might not have been a direct one. You know, maybe in places like the Johnson County suburbs it was. I mean, looking at how that's changing. But it also could have been a more indirect one. I mean, changing how people might have just perceived or, you know, received the way that Kobach campaigned.
By nationalizing himself, Kobach inexorably tied himself to the president, who was a problem in the 3rd District and in Johnson County in particular.
C.J. Grover was campaign manager for Congressman Kevin Yoder.
I think that the entire vote margin that the secretary lost by, you can account for it in Johnson County. Mm-hmm. And if you remove Johnson County, it was a basically even race. But if you go to that it was something like 46,000 and 43,000 of it, I think, was in Johnson County. So I think tying himself to Trump may not have hurt him in the rest of the state, but it did fatal damage to him in the race because of the way Johnson County voters perceived the president and perceived him in the same way.
CJ, that night, I asked the secretary, which counties are you watching tonight?
Caroline Sweeney with KCTV 5 in Kansas City.
And he said he was watching Sedgwick County for himself and Johnson County for Governor-elect Kelly. And I think that's very telling of just where the campaign may have been looking at their last-minute priority. So Johnson County, I think we all know, is going to continue to play a big role. But I found that answer very interesting.
I mean, to his credit, he stayed very consistent. I mean, there was no pivot.
No, I'm not even sure he can.
I don't know.
I mean, they made a very strong, at the end, all of their TV for the last 2 weeks was about Trump.
Yeah. So there was no pivot. The question is, why was there no pivot? Was it a strategic error that they thought that Orman was going to do better than what he did do, which would have allowed basically to win the gubernatorial with just base Republican voters?
At Leopold was campaign manager for Steve Watkins.
Or was it maybe he didn't want to risk his brand for possible something else, some sort of appointment or something like that? If things didn't work out, didn't pivot, he should have, and he didn't. And the question is, was it a strategic error or a conscious choice?
But I'm curious about that. Exactly how would he have pivoted? Because he was talking about tax cuts. He was talking about smaller government. He was talking about being tough on immigration. He was talking about Second Amendment stuff. How would you, if you were running his campaign, how would you have pivoted?
Well, I would have talked to swing voters. Like in the 2nd District, they literally, the universe that we were talking to in the 2nd District, that the Watkins campaign was talking to in the 2nd District, was about 35,000 households. That was almost exclusively and they were swing GOP, their independents. There was no overlap with Kobach. Kobach was base Republican voters. When you try to do like door knocking with them, there was no overlap. It's like, those people are already gonna vote and they probably like him, you know? That's how you pivot. That's put down the machine gun, stuff like that.
Yeah, but it was almost like the criticism of that was a challenge to him that he felt the need to respond to and to show, as he said, I don't back down, I double down.
Well, I think at that point, he probably like quadrupled down. I think he doubled down a long time ago.
Again, Hunter Woodall with the Kansas City Star.
That was the thing. I'm not sure, I don't know if anybody in this room could say this, you know, with any clarity, is like, can you moderate Kris Kobach? And I think John's getting to that. I'm not sure you can. I mean, Kris Kobach's never going to go for Medicaid expansion. He's never going to go for stricter gun laws. You know, he batted around what to do with schools, but he's never going to be, you know, a moderate on school funding. So I'm not quite sure it was ever there. To the point about him kind of in his ties to the president, I mean, let's be clear, Kobach was Trump before Trump was Trump. I mean, Kobach very much had this brand. He didn't, you know, and he tied himself to Trump early, but he had this brand in Kansas, you know, almost, you know, as soon as he was elected. And getting to the whole point that Patrick made about kind of the circus, the spectacle essence of this, I mean, you look at from the day he announced, you know, I believe it was June of 2017, it was right after Brownback's tax cuts had largely been rolled back. He comes out, you know, and says, this is terrible. I hate that they did this. Ties himself to Brownback and the tax cuts. And then, you know, as time goes on, you have Trump Jr. come out. You have the ongoing court case over proof of citizenship and, you know, and all that. So his name's always in the news. You have Ted Nugent come out for him. You have Donald Trump Jr. come out for him. You eventually have Trump come out for him. The replica machine gun. He got very good at getting himself in the news and saying, okay, look at me, look at me, look at what I'm doing. And I know for us as reporters, I think both John and I did this, I think Caroline did as well, you make a conscious effort to, not, you know, you're not going to report on Chris every time he pulls out the replica, you know, machine gun Jeep. You know, that's not news every time he does that. It's news the first time, then okay, he's doing it again. That's worth a note. But you don't keep reporting on it every time he brings out the Jeep. But it really, you know, seemed to turn him away from doing, okay, here's what my policy is. Because he seemed to welcome, I think, that spectacle. Because, I mean, it was funny, you know, he did the machine gun bit for on a Saturday, and we got to break that story. And I was at the gym, and I got, oh, my goodness, like, this is really happening. So we get that story out there, and I texted the campaign. 5 minutes later, I had a statement regarding the whole Snowflake bit. So it seemed like they were prepared, knowing exactly what they were doing. But Chris also did something really interesting. He very much challenged, I think, kind of the Republican stalwarts in the party, because, Nancy Kassebaum came out and had endorsed, on Laura Kelly's campaign, and, Bill Graves had done that earlier. And he very much got upset with them doing that. And he really, I think, struggled because, their statement was really harsh on Kassebaum. I think for your average Republican voter, she's very well respected. Do you really want the person you're voting for governor disrespecting this very, well-established, historically famous woman who represented your state for so long?
Hunter, but remember on election night, you and I were standing there at like 4:30, and he said that comment. And you and I both pushed back and said, are you sure that's what you want to say about these two, respected people in the state? And he walked that back just a little bit.
And it was interesting because we had to correct him. He was like, oh, the same people that opposed Brownback are opposing me, these Republicans who had endorsed Democrats. And that is not the case. Bill Graves did not endorse Paul Davis over Brownback in 14, and Kassebaum did not endorse Davis over Brownback in 14. Now, Graves had gotten involved in the 16 campaigns a little bit, with the Save Kansas Coalition, but he very much did struggle with that, and he actually kind of, as Caroline notes, was like, okay, I shouldn't criticize Kassebaum this much. So I think he realized how that rhetoric could hurt him, even there at the end.
That's Hunter Woodall of the Kansas City Star, part of the Kansas Post-Election Conference at the Dole Institute of Politics. Today on KPR Presents, we're hearing about the 2018 Kansas elections from reporters, campaign managers, and University of Kansas political science professor Patrick Miller.
One impression that I had, I think you're right, you're not going to moderate Chris Kobach on issues, but just watching the campaign ads, it did seem to me, and y'all may disagree, that at the end, he maybe pivoted back more towards talking about issues, particularly education, that might have been important for swing voters. I think when the campaign started off, you had Laura Kelly very much talking about Kansas issues, staying very focused on that. You had Greg Orman over here being all boo political parties. Kobach being Kobach in the way that we think about him, the Jeep and poking Nancy Kassebaum in the eye, mm-hmm. and things like that. But it seemed like at the end, maybe the last month, he was talking more, and his campaign was talking more about education, getting defensive about attacks on that, but also trying to maybe soften the edges of that somewhat in a way that didn't make him seem as conservative, even though he still had very conservative policies. And maybe that, maybe if that impression is correct, that ultimately did hurt him. The only bit of data that we had on Brownback in the campaign is you look at the Fox AP poll they did of voters at the end, and what, 78% of voters had a negative perception of the Brownback tax experiment. So, maybe if that perception is correct, if Kobach is coming back and talking more about those issues that maybe made people think of Brownback, that was not a useful strategy for him.
Again, Jared Soon with the Singularis Group, a consulting firm that works on Republican campaigns.
Yeah, I think in their minds, the education play was him pivoting, but I think I would question to a degree if you're an education voter out there. First of all, I don't think you were probably undecided on the governor's race, and so I don't think you are. I question how much that actually was able to potentially move undecided voters, and whether or not there were other wedge issues out there that might have appealed to swing voters, whether it be jobs and economy, which really never became a subject in the debate in the race that much. He talked about term limits, culture of corruption type, cleaning up government, which I think could have had greater legs with a wider swath of swing voters.
Well, it goes back to that believability factor.
Right.
C.J. Grover with Congressman Kevin Yoder's campaign.
Voters don't believe that, really Republicans in general at this point in Kansas, have trustworthy on the education issue. I know this is a Kansas-focused segment, but you look at the Missouri Senate race, Claire McCaskill ran a lot of ads on immigration and saying that she's the stronger border security candidate. And I just think in today's day and age, it's not very believable for a Democrat to be trusted as the border security candidate over a Republican, especially one in Josh Hawley, who so clearly embraced the president in the border message. So it sort of mirrors that in a way. I think you saw the unsuccessful candidates making arguments that just weren't believable to voters.
Okay, I want to move along to the general election a little bit more now. And I first want to just make an observation about Mr. Orman, who was the independent candidate of the race. He ran a fairly strong race for Senate until it was nationalized back in 14. Wound up with 6.5%. But I know, Patrick, you have written skeptically about independent candidacies, maybe not Mr. Orman's in particular. But you want to share any of your thoughts on that?
Oh, interesting. You know, there's a whole, let's not even get into that. Look it up on Twitter.
All of us who've written about Orman have gotten the tweet from an Orman person saying something on the order of, you're buying into this false narrative of Orman being the spoiler, because they really pushed back on that. And we were struck by how little the cast of the race changed, including with him.
I mean, so, okay, a year ago, Greg Orman and one of the women, I remember her name, but she's involved with this national independent organization, they wrote this op-ed, two op-eds from the Kansas City Star, that as a political scientist who traffics in data and looks at data over decades about independent candidates and partisanship, it just absolutely rung totally false for me, and it was this column that, oh, Americans are less partisan in turning to independents. No, they're not. And so I wrote a response back to that because it just was not factually correct. It was distorting a lot of data, particularly Gallup data. And so I wrote back this response about, well, here's what's actually going on. And of course, they declare jihad on me, which, whatever, you know, I'm half Sicilian, I can roll with that. But the drama of that aside, but no, I was incredibly skeptical because, you know, I think if you dig down below the surface of the percentage of Americans who claim they're independent but don't really act like it, you look at the success rates of independents, they're not getting more successful. In fact, we're going to end this election with fewer independents in state legislatures than we had even going into the election. You know, we are not moving towards a viable third party. Voters are not less partisan. They're more partisan than ever. And, you know, and nothing about Mr. Orman in particular. I'm sure he's a very nice person. I've never met him. You know, I'm glad he ran. But I think that a candidate like that, whether it is Mr. Orman or a candidate anywhere else, faces immense structural challenges that no matter how rich or successful or appealing of a person that you might be, you're not necessarily going to be able to overcome that. You know, that money can buy you infrastructure, but it bought him 6.5%. And in that sense, Mr. Orman is like practically every other independent candidate in this country who has run for statewide office. He was a competent, normal human being with a nice bank account, and that's about where they end up. So, I mean, that was a source of my criticism. I think people interpreted that as some kind of personal thing. It wasn't, because like I don't know him. But, you know, I think it was very clear after this election that we are not moving towards our party system fundamentally changing. And we saw that here in Kansas, and we saw it everywhere else.
What it reminded me of is you see this happen in states that have runoff elections, where you have a multi-way primary or general, and you will see essentially the top two or three candidates start rising to the top, and then very, very frequently, as you get close to the end, that third person or the fourth person just start, the bottom falls out of their numbers and so forth, because people just, they view it as potentially wasting their vote.
Again, Jared Soon with the Singularis Group.
And I think that you saw that a lot with the Orman candidacy. The other thing is that I would say that when you look at Trump's disapprove or approve numbers, his strongly disapprove numbers, or the strongly disapprove is where virtually 100% of the disapproval comes from. And so people that were left of center or against the president, they weren't looking for an independent option. They wanted a Democrat to vote for. And so I think in a different electoral environment, there might have been slightly different outcome, or he would have at least done better. But I just don't think that there was any appetite on the part of left of center voters for anything less than a full Democrat. And then the other thing is I think that just from the message development side of the Ormond campaign, they were very tactful in terms of selling the independent message, but I don't think they ever closed the loop of, you know, what does it mean for you? How is this actually going to impact your pocketbook? How is it going to impact your life? And, you know, the whole theory of independence in political discourse is great, but I don't feel like they really made it palatable as to a motivating factor for a voter. And what it would mean for their daily lives.
Yeah, it was what struck me was how little traction Ormond got. And I remember a comment from a Democratic National Committee member who said, what really, and this was in October, he said, what really unites Democrats right now is how, and I'll clean it up, how angry we are at Greg Ormond.
Again, John Hanna with the Associated Press.
You know, I was looking at some numbers last night, and it was all over the Ormond's effect was all over the map. You could see a few counties, and you could see counties in western Kansas where he actually held Kobach's numbers down as Kelly was roughly the same. There were some counties, rural counties, where they seemed to split in terms of how much they lost and some others. So it struck me that he just never really became the big, I mean, we were talking about candidates who are overestimated. He really, really was overestimated.
I think you look at the execution of that, right? So Mr. Ormond, I mean, first, look at the Fox poll at the end. Only 17% of Kansans have a negative view of both political parties, not the highly inflated number that he was pushing. Laura Kelly won those voters over 70%. He didn't win them. She won independents. He didn't win them. If you look at how he marketed himself, he tried to project an image, and politicians do this all the time, where the image is not necessarily the substance. And I think that was a fair critique in his case, because he projected this image of, I'm this moderate centrist, but then whenever he tried to differentiate himself from Laura Kelly, he was hitting her from the left. Whether it was on Medicaid expansion or Kobach's voter regulations or guns, you know, I think particularly at the peak of that, it was fair to wonder who was the biggest liberal in the race, whether it was him or Kelly. And so if I had to create the prototypical independent candidate who could come in and actually make it work, you know, it might be someone with the business profile or the professional background of Mr. Ormond, but not with his partisan history, you know, particularly as a big Democratic donor, and certainly not with his issue positions.
That's Patrick Miller, who teaches political science at the University of Kansas. Dr. Miller was part of the Dole Institute of Politics post-election conference held November 28, 2018. I'm Kay McIntyre. We'll turn our attention to the Kansas races for U.S. Congress in the 2nd and 3rd districts right after this.